country will be woke no longer.
I was woke no longer. About halfway through that speech.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
Couldn't stay awake.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
What are y'all?
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and elsewhere across the country and the world, blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com with, as you can tell, a whole lot of show to get to today. Thank you for joining us for it. Welcome to the Bradcast. We will be joined by our two guests momentarily, as our friends Heather Digby Parton and the man known simply as Driftglass will be joining us once again to help us make sense of Donald Trump's first joint address to Congress in his second term. I'm sure you enjoyed it, Desi Doyen.
Oh, gosh, nothing but enjoyment the entire time.
For now, I will say this. That speech last night, it was just so long and so boring.
Yeah.
I'm not sure, but I think the speech may still be going on today. I haven't checked, but anyway, in some other very quick but important news today, first, after hailing his 25% tariffs against our two largest trading partners and longtime allies, Canada and Mexico, on Tuesday, after officially enacting those tariffs earlier in the day, leading to another plunge in the stock market, and after declaring that the U.S. auto industry was delighted with that new tax on Americans against imports from the two countries, the Trump administration announced on Wednesday that it would be pausing those tariffs against cars coming into the U.S. from Canada and Mexico for 1 month. I'm sure we will discuss that and more with Digby and Driftglass and in the days ahead. But perhaps the most important news of the past 24 hours came from our corrupted U.S. Supreme Court, in what is one of the first early tests of just how it may or may not hold the line of constitutional law and order against the second Trump administration. The High Court on Wednesday morning backed a federal judge's power to order the Trump administration to pay $2 billion to the U.S. Agency for International Aid Development, USAID contractors, largely for aid already appropriated by Congress and work already completed by the contractors, which the Trump administration had attempted to freeze. In doing so, the court, in a very narrow 5-4 vote, rejected an emergency application filed by the Trump Justice Department after U.S. District Judge Amir Ali issued a series of increasingly direct and urgent rulings demanding that the government follow his repeated orders and unfreeze funds that Donald Trump put on hold with an executive order signed on his first day in office. The Supreme Court had delayed acting on the case for about a week since agreeing to review it. In the meantime, the contractors have not been paid since Judge Amir first issued his order that the administration must pay them back on February 13. Four Republican justices, Samuel Alito, Clarence Thomas, Neil Gorsuch, and Brett Kavanaugh, dissented from the majority's denial of the application, with Republican Chief Justice John Roberts and Republican Justice Amy Coney Barrett joining all three of the court's Democratically appointed justices. In his 8-page dissent for the right-wing majority, Alito wrote that Judge Ali did not have, quote, unchecked power to compel the government to pay out $2 billion taxpayer dollars. I am stunned, Alito added disingenuously.
Yes.
The court's brief order was otherwise unsigned, which is typical when the justices act on emergency applications, but the ruling represented one of the court's first moves in response to the flurry of litigation that has been filed in response to Trump's efforts to slash government spending pretty much willy-nilly and to take complete control of the executive branch, including independent executive branch agencies, often in direct contradiction of both laws and appropriations adopted by Congress. The bottom line here, it seems to me, for the moment, is that a bare majority of the court ruled against Donald Trump on one of his signature projects, at least for now. That project, canceling almost all foreign aid, despite the broad success of the programs in question and their relatively small price tag, comprising less than 1% of the overall annual federal budget.
And of course, they are also contracts, contracts that were signed by the federal government for work that was done.
Already done, correct.
Yeah, so it seems like contract law should come into play here.
The order was released first thing in the morning on Wednesday. That is not typical when the court acts on emergency applications. The majority may have wished to avoid releasing it at night on Tuesday in order to avoid thwarting Trump's speech hours before he delivered his first address to Congress since taking office again. Trump's January 20th executive order supposedly temporarily ended thousands of programs around the world purportedly to assess whether they were, quote, fully aligned with the foreign policy of the president of the United States, unquote. Recipients and other nonprofit groups filed lawsuits, two lawsuits, challenging the freeze as an unconstitutional exercise of presidential power that thwarted congressional appropriations for USAID, including about $1.5 billion for work that had already been completed by contractors. The group said the frozen funds have created cascading crises, resulting in thousands of layoffs, threatening critical medical care around the world, leaving food rotting in warehouses for starving children, ruining businesses, and risking the spread of diseases, including to American shores, and political instability everywhere. Quote, one cannot overstate the impact of that unlawful course of conduct on businesses large and small forced to shut down their programs and let employees go, on hungry children across the globe who will go without, on populations around the world facing deadly disease, and on our constitutional order. That, according to lawyers for Global Health Council, one of the member organizations of health groups, who wrote that in one of the suits. Judge Ali, a Joe Biden appointee at the federal U.S. District Court in D.C., issued a temporary restraining order originally on February 13, prohibiting the administration from ending or pausing payments of appropriated money under contracts that were in place before Trump took office. He said the administration offered no explanation for the blanket suspension of the aid that Congress had directed to be paid. But Trump administration officials appeared to defy that order, saying that they were entitled to continue to conduct a case-by-case review of the grants and the contracts and halt or approve spending one at a time. The plaintiffs had to repeatedly return to court to ask Judge Ali to enforce the February 13 order. And on February 25, after the administration had been unable to present evidence that they had unfrozen these funds as the court had ordered, the judge issued a very specific order telling officials to pay more than $1.5 billion in already completed aid work, setting a hard line for midnight the next day. Rather than paying, however, as ordered, the administration claimed that they had suddenly, in less than 24 hours, completed their case-by-case review of thousands of existing contracts, canceling most of them permanently, and otherwise, just before the midnight deadline, they went to the Supreme Court to file this emergency application. Democrats on Capitol Hill hailed the ruling from the high court, arguing that it shows that Trump's power to freeze spending is not unlimited. Quote, that money had already been appropriated, said Congressman Gregory Meeks of New York, the top Democrat in the House Foreign Affairs Committee. saying things were already in action. And so I think the Supreme Court ruled the right way, and now the administration needs to unfreeze them and allow those contractors and that work to be done. Whether he does that, however, remains to be seen. If he does not, well, then we really could be at the precipice of the constitutional crisis that many have been warning and fearing since Trump's return to office. So that remains to be seen. On Wednesday night, following his first address to the joint session of Congress in his second term, Trump could be seen and heard shaking hands with Chief Justice John Roberts, telling him, quote, "Thank you again. Thank you again. I won't forget it," while patting the Chief Justice on the shoulder as if to be thanking him for his ruling last summer, granting criminal immunity to presidents, ensuring that Trump would not face jail time for either of his two federal indictments relating to his attempts to steal the 2020 election, including the incitement of the January 6, 2021 insurrection at the Capitol and his theft of thousands of pages of highly classified national security documents upon leaving office the first time. So, yes, this story will absolutely be continuing, but for now, good news for, well, the Constitution, the rule of law. We'll see if that remains. In other news, before we get to Digby and Driftglass and Trump's really boring speech on Tuesday, first-term congressman and 70-year-old former Houston, Texas mayor Sylvester Turner died on Wednesday after suffering a medical emergency following Trump's address to Congress. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries called Turner a, quote, "iconic leader and a fighter until the end." He said, though he was newly elected to Congress, Rep. Turner had a long and distinguished career in public service and spent decades fighting for the people of Houston. Just prior to Trump's speech, Turner posted a video on social media with his guest, Angela Hernandez, who was advocating for her daughter, who has a rare genetic disorder. Quote, "Angela is here to advocate on the importance of Medicaid," Turner said in that video. "So please let people know, don't mess with Medicaid," he said. Turner was elected to fill the seat vacated after the death of Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee of Texas, who died of pancreatic cancer last July. Turner easily won the seat, and he was sworn in on January 3rd this year. He was a member of the Congressional Black Caucus. His death means now that Republicans hold a still historically narrow 218 to 214 majority in the U.S. House, a very narrow majority. According to under that breakdown, Republicans can still only afford to lose about one vote on any vote if all lawmakers are present and voting. According to Texas election law, Governor Greg Abbott, a Republican, must call a special election to fill the vacancy, but that process is likely now to take months, with the hard right partisan Texas governor unlikely to be in a hurry to fill that seat, which will almost certainly go to a Democrat from the liberal Houston congressional district. Now, there was an outside, a very outside shot that Democrats could somehow regain control of the U.S. House after three upcoming special elections this year to fill the seats of Republicans who were appointed to roles in the Trump administration. But all three of those seats are in very, very Republican districts. So at best, there was a very, very long shot.
But it was doable. It was plausible.
It was a shot. And a shot that would now seem, anyway, to be dashed for the moment with the sudden death of Congressman Turner. All right, let's take a quick break here, and we'll come back with the great Digby and Driftglass on Trump's Tuesday night, sort of bizarre, certainly dull address to a joint session of Congress. I'm Brad Friedman, and you are listening to The Bradcast.
Five major corporations now control more than 80% of the media in the United States, but they don't control us. The Bradcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener-supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. You can make a difference. Support independent media. Drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
America's momentum is back. Our spirit is back. Our pride is back. Our confidence is back.
I'm going back to the sun. I'm going back where I belong.
Don't worry. We won't be playing much of that guy's voice, since I know it sounds like fingernails on a blackboard to many of us at this point. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman of bradblog.com. It was the longest such joint address to Congress in history, and though not officially a State of the Union address for reasons too dull to explain, it was largely Donald Trump's first State of the Union address of his second term in office. It also almost certainly contained the most outright lies of any address to Congress anywhere at any time, likely outpacing even Trump's own previous such addresses, where typically presidents call for national unity and such. That decidedly did not occur on Tuesday night. Trump's speech was relentlessly partisan, boasting about his election victory and criticizing Democrats for failing to recognize what he hailed as his unprecedented achievements in his first 6 weeks in office. He vowed to keep up his campaign of, quote, swift and unrelenting action in reorienting the nation's economy, immigration, and foreign policy in what AP described as an unyielding address to Congress and the nation that left Democratic legislators to register their dissent with stone faces, placards calling out, quote, lies, and one legislator's ejection from the chamber as he attempted to confront Trump from the floor about Trump's plans to cut Medicaid after running a campaign in which he vowed he would not do so. While Trump has always reveled in his reputation for tough talk, a look back at 2017 AP finds when Trump gave his first speech to Congress in his first term reveals how Trump has only become far more of a hardliner since then. 8 years ago, he talked about working with Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau to support women entrepreneurs in both countries. On Tuesday night, he hailed tariffs and trade wars between our two countries. In 2017, he paid homage to, quote, our nation's path towards civil rights. He said real and positive immigration reform is possible. And there were no references to Barack Obama, who he replaced in the White House. Now, Trump is feuding with Trudeau over tariffs. He's used his speech to criticize anti-discrimination initiatives, which he's been eliminating across the federal government. And he repeatedly derided President Joe Biden, blaming him for the recent rise in egg prices and calling him, quote, the worst president in American history. He placed himself alongside the country's first president, George Washington, when discussing what he said were the flood of early achievements of his second term. He inflated the scale of his victory in November, the margin of which was actually among the smallest in American history. He described Democrats as, quote, radical left lunatics and as a lost cause. He lavished praise on billionaire Elon Musk, his top campaign funder, who he has tasked with overhauling the federal government, canceling billions of dollars in government initiatives and programs, and firing tens, if not hundreds of thousands of government workers. Even as he declared, quote, the days of rule by unelected bureaucrats are over. Ironical that. He ignored Wall Street losses that wiped out gains since the November election in the face of tariff and trade war threats against our trading partners and best allies, describing tariffs as integral to his political agenda. For rich foreigners, he talked up his plans to introduce a $5 million gold card, giving the wealthy preferred immigration status as he continued his vow for mass deportations for millions of people who cannot afford to buy favor from Donald Trump. At another point, he gushed that his trade policies will be a boon for the agriculture industry, even as farm state senators have warned that tariffs could hurt them and that Trump's cuts to foreign aid have already done so. In truth, I found the evening, short of the Democrats' varying attempts to counter Trump's remarks, to be utterly forgettable. While it was the longest State of the Union address in American history, it more closely echoed some of his interminable campaign rallies. But frankly, he was also guilty of the worst crime I think you can accuse Trump of, perhaps the only one now that he's been unconstitutionally granted immunity from all of his crimes by his corrupted Supreme Court. And that is the crime of, frankly, being boring. I thought the speech was not just really long, but really, really dull. It was the first joint address to Congress to feature two white men, however, Vice President J.D. Vance and House Speaker Mike Johnson sitting up on the podium behind the president for a very long time, though I will admit it was nice to see someone with a beard behind the president of the United States. It was also nice to see J.D. Vance there as well. Joining us now for cleverer insights than I have to offer on all of this are our two old friends and fellow old school bloggers, Heather Digby Parton, the award-winning columnist at Salon and proprietor of the beloved Digby's Hullabaloo blog, and the man known mostly as Driftglass, though occasionally as Bill, who writes the long-running Driftglass blog and co-hosts the Professional Left podcast each week, rain or shine or snow, from his home in what he describes as flyover country, Illinois. Hey, guys, welcome back to the broadcast.
Hello.
Good to be here.
All snide comments aside, at least on my part for the moment, Heather, big picture first, as usual, before we get into some of the details and specifics, including the Democrats' attempts at pushback. What did you make of the overall event on Tuesday night, and am I somehow underestimating how utterly forgettable and or boring it really was?
Well, you're not underestimating how boring it was, that's for sure, because it was absolutely interminable. And I sat there with my husband watching it, and we literally didn't say a word for the entire time because we were struggling to keep awake. It was horrifyingly dull and not news to anybody who's been paying attention, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we all knew, his long litany of all his alleged accomplishments of the past 6 weeks. You know, I wrote a piece for Salon today, mm-hmm. In which I sort of framed it as if you haven't been paying attention to the news mm-hmm. over the past 6 weeks and you decided to tune into that, you would have been shell-shocked by what he was saying, because the litany of atrocities, which are real to some extent, at least that he says, you know, these are things that he's actually done or has been lying about doing, mm-hmm. You would have been stunned. But for the rest of us, we all knew this. We've been following this every day. We've been seeing everything that he's doing, and it was all very, very predictable that he was going to be this way. But what you said was absolutely true, and I think it's important to point out, and I hadn't actually thought about it in those terms, the difference between his first address mm-hmm. like this when he was first elected yeah. and this one. And what that says to me, number one, he's completely free to do whatever he wants. In fact, you know, he knows that there's no accountability. Nothing will ever happen to him. He doesn't have to run again. If he wants to stay in office, he'll just cancel elections or do something like that. I mean, he is no longer encumbered by mm-hmm. the law, by the Constitution, by anything. And it shows. I mean, he's saying that, you know, we're going to take Greenland one way or the other. I mean, that's the kind of stuff you just would never hear from an American president mm-hmm. in a public address like this. But it also sort of exposed what I've been kind of thinking and writing a lot about, which is, you know, we've been, what really is motivating him? And everybody says, well, it's money. You know, I think that's a given for him. He knows that he's just blatantly taking money now. People are paying him $5 million mm-hmm. to have dinner with him at Mar-a-Lago. It's going directly into his pocket. So there's no limit. And he knows that all his billionaire buddies are going to take care of him. I just think the only thing that's motivating him now is anger, resentment, and revenge. And what you saw last night, that comment that he made at the beginning about the Democrats will never give him any credit, they'll never applaud, they'll never stand up for a bunch of things he says he's taking credit for that haven't happened, like, you know, diseases that he supposedly will have cured,
sure,
or
yeah,
bringing world peace or whatever, and they didn't stand up and clap. That is the look in his eye, the sound of his voice, to me, once again, validated my belief that this guy is consumed with anger. And that is what's driving him. He's mad at Zelensky because Zelensky, you know, he holds him responsible for the first impeachment. He's mad at Trudeau because he's young and good looking. He's mad at the American people. He's mad at the world.
Yeah.
And that is why he's doing this stuff. And I don't think there's anything more complicated about it than that. You want big picture? Donald's pissed. That's the big picture.
Driftglass, I'm old enough to remember about a year or so ago when all of the Republicans were outraged. Remember their pearl clutching after Joe Biden's State of the Union, which they all described as the most offensively partisan thing that they had ever seen in the sacred U.S. House chamber. did you happen to spot any Republicans like Lindsey Graham expressing his stunned objections at the at Trump's shameful partisan behavior, describing Biden as the worst president in American history, Democrats as radical left lunatics? Did you happen to spot any of that? And otherwise, how did you enjoy the speech?
If you're trying to tell me in your subtle way that Republicans are colossal hypocrites,
what?
You have succeeded, sir.
What?
Excellent. Good job. Yeah, no, this
wow.
is always the case. They get real mad about something and then 20 minutes later, relying on the amnesia of their base, they do the same thing that they accuse Democrats of doing 10 times worse. And everyone looks at each other like, isn't God going to strike them dead or something? Nope. They're just going to go plowing on. I think you had it exactly right. At the top of my notes over here, I have boring underlined because it's boring. It's a boring speech.
Yeah.
And it was boring in the worst way possible, because I tried to figure out how many people wrote this thing. I'm figuring about six, at least six, because they bolted like the worst, dullest part of his whip up the idiots rally speeches, which by this point are like a circus that the elephant's dying and the lion is dead and the ringmaster's stupid. And there's like five people like, yay, peanuts, this is great. So they got that part. And then they bolted it to like the structure of a State of the Union address, where you start to point to people up there. Like, look at that guy, cured him of cancer. Look at that guy, made him a cop. Look at that guy. And it was just, and that's the worst of both possible worlds. And then, God, at the end, I made note that the end sounded like somebody fed a bunch of Peggy Noonan garbage into an AI and then got it drunk, because it was, you know, the glow America, future is great and everything's wonderful. And no one's going to remember any of this. Mm. But, and then somebody convinced the idiot to read numbers, lots of numbers.
Yeah.
America loves numbers. And so I just sat there looking, you know, at myself. I excused myself. I got another drink because that's the only one I'm making through this thing. And it was just dull and boring.
Yeah.
And every attempt, I think he's run out of, I think we have finally figured out there's nothing you can do to outrage us anymore. Your stupid sayings, your this is the best that's ever been a million times, your little sundowning explorations and wanderings into how great you are and how oppressed you are. Nobody cares. We're not shocked by that anymore. We don't take it for granted. We know you're a nut. We know you're a tyrant. We know you're an evil, vicious, I agree entirely with Digby, consumed by anger, a-hole. But we're not shocked by any of this anymore, because this is what we come to expect from you and your entire party.
We're not shocked anymore.
No.
I wonder if America is, though, to be frank. And
Well, I this is a conversation my wife and I had, because we're both writers, and it's when people say America or the voters or the people, we're real interested in who exactly they're talking about, because there's a third of the country that loves Donald Trump no matter what he does, you know, and there's a third of us who hate everything about him. He's going to cure diseases and raise the dead. He still won't applaud him. And then there's the third of the people who are blissfully unaware that any of this is going on at all. We're totally checked out. So I wonder, you know, who's left to convince of anything? Who is there on the fence about this guy's been around for, it seems like, 1,000 years? So who is there left to be, you know, persuaded, cajoled, shocked, outraged, left? The only thing that's going to shock the people in the middle is economic hardship, the recession that Trump is bringing down on their heads, cutting off their services, invading their Social Security. And that might actually light a fire under them and get them moving in the right direction.
And, I do think Desi Doyen is not decided yet which side she's on this.
I just had a quick thought about all of this, a side angle on the idea of why it was so boring. It was something that David Rothkopf at the Daily Beast had said. He said that being boring is a tactic of despots. Not only do they love to hear themselves speak, but they speak in ways designed to desensitize the populace to the threat that they pose. So he called it an anesthetic cocktail that is so powerful it numbs people to the outrages.
Yeah, it was kind of sleepy and hypnotic in a way.
There's also, if I could just add, that one of the things, the points of that, of what Rothkopf is saying, and I don't know if he said it in the piece, but that it occurs to me, you can't talk about this speech without, and it was incredibly dull, was without noting the reaction from the Republicans, which was so over the top.
Rapturous.
And beyond, it was a rapturous, ecstatic. They were screaming, they were yelling, they were leaping to their feet at every single thing he said. Now, some of that was just their usual oppositional defiant disorder because the Democrats weren't responding, so they had to respond twice as much. But really, there is Trump saying the most boring garbage and the same stuff that he's been saying, you know, for God, forever. Mm-hmm. And they had to demonstrate their fealty and their love for him and their adoration. So they're jumping up there for those numbers on Social Security. I mean, they're jumping to their feet because he said, and we found 2.7 million people.
Yeah, even though they know it's
over
nonsense.
150. They know it's nonsense.
Right.
It's boring. It's stupid. And yet they're jumping to their feet and the energy behind it. It was bizarre because we're watching this incredibly dull speech. And I think most people in the audience are just, he's doing what Rothkopf said. It's some kind of, anesthetic. And yet here these other people are, they're just screaming with joy. It was weird. I mean, that was just but it tells you everything you need to know about why the Republicans have turned into potted plants. I mean, they are completely non-existent now.
And you know what that reminded me of? Saddam Hussein parliament meeting.
Yeah,
where
exactly.
He's up there sort of lolling up waving his hand, and people are just shrieking because they know that if they don't, the bad man is going to make them go away forever.
Well, we need to start watching for Republicans doing that crying thing they do in North Korea in the parliament there whenever they hear their dear leader speak.
It's only a matter of time.
At this point, I think it is. But let's talk about the Democrats and their response. Congressman Al Green, Democrat of Texas, disrupted the speech right at the beginning. And I thought it was kind of a highlight of the night. He was eventually removed by the House Sergeant at Arms at the order of Speaker Mike Johnson, who, by the way, his chief of staff, I understand, was arrested for DUI after the speech last night. So congratulations.
No, DEI. You got that wrong.
Oh, for arrested for DEI. My mistake.
Yeah.
In any event, after being removed from the chamber, the congressman explained, Congressman Green, why he did what he did to the press pool outside the chamber. Let me play his remarks and we'll get some of your thoughts.
The president said he had a mandate, and I was making it clear to the president that he has no mandate to cut Medicaid. I have people who are very fearful. These are poor people, and they have only Medicaid in their lives when it comes to their health care. And I want him to know that his budget calls for deep cuts in Medicaid. It is the best way to get it across to a person who uses his incivility against our civility. He is a person who has consistently been used incivility against civility. I'm willing to suffer whatever punishment is available to me. I've said I'll accept the punishment, but it's worth it to let people know that there are some of us who are going to stand up against this president's desire to cut Medicaid, Medicare, and Social Security.
So, Driftglass, what did you think of that that moment, that particular form of protest that Congressman Green was speaking about there? And would you like to have seen more Democrats do that? I mean, frankly, the speech was long enough as is, but I would have loved to have watched that all night long, if even if I suspect it might have turned folks against Democrats. Your thoughts on that?
Well, he picked the right issue. Medicaid is on the chopping block, and Medicaid helps the elderly and children. And that's who they're going after. They're going after the most weak and most powerless people in society, and they're going to come for them. So he raised the correct issue. I'm delighted he stood up. I'm delighted he did what he did. I think the entire ritual is completely outdated and silly, that we watch this thing because we're required to watch it, but nothing ever really comes of it. And I think that Democrats are in a position where there's no playbook for how to do this. My wife and I were talking about America after the Civil War, when spiritualism was in vogue, because it was such a shattering thing. After World War One, there was so much weirdness going on. It was such an upheaval. And Democrats tried so hard to stop this from happening and worked so hard and spent so much time and money, and they lost. We lost. And it's just a shattering experience. And so I have a lot of gentle feelings towards people who are trying to cope any way they can. So everyone's trying something. There are protests in state capitals. We had a couple here. There is Al Green standing up like a man and yelling at this a-hole and calling him out on attempt to hurt people who are weak and poor, which is great. There are people holding up signs. There are people walking out. There are people boycotting. And I think this really is a case of a lot of people hitting every key on the piano trying to find the right one, because there isn't a playbook for how to deal with half of your country voted for a fascist and are thrilled that he's in power. And he is a bad man, and he's a stupid man, and he's a vicious man, and they love it. And there's no, unless you got a time machine, you can go back 50 years and push the Republican Party in a different direction. There isn't a way to cope with this that anyone knows. So people are trying everything, and I applaud them.
I think, Heather, I think that along with those very polite placards that Democrats are holding up that read things like Save Medicaid and Musk Steals and just simply the word false, I actually think that shook him up at the beginning. That and Al Green's protest there, I think it got under his skin. I think you could see him visibly angry about that. Like I said, I would have liked to see more of that. It would not have bothered me if one by one each member of Congress pulled an Al Green there one after another and had to be removed one after another after another. But, you know, like I said, maybe that would turn folks against Democrats. So what were your thoughts on that part of the evening?
Well, you know, I mean, it would have turned some people against Democrats, mainly certain elected Democrats who are out there chastising Al Green today for doing what he did and being upset that they wore pink or did whatever. And there are plenty of people, you know, there's always a critic, right? they were criticized. My feeling about this is that we're dealing with, this is an hallucinogenic situation, right? I mean, this is as abnormal as it gets. In fact, one of the best things that happened last night was I think her name is, Melanie Stansbury from New Mexico.
Yes.
She stood there with a sign as Trump was walking down the aisle that said, "This is not normal."
Yes.
I'm thinking that's a pretty clever way of putting it. And then some idiot, some horrible Republican, I don't know who, but I think he was from Texas, grabbed the sign and threw it up in the air as Trump is walking down. I'm going, wow. That just kind of encapsulated how incredibly bizarre this whole thing is. So you're right. It's very difficult to combat this. We're dealing with something that is way outside what we've known before. So I'm with Driftglass on this. I think that people are trying everything that they, you know, they're trying things. And to me, what that means is you have to take risks. Yes, you've got to risk that people are going to be upset that Al Green stood up and said something, that people are going to be upset that the Democrats didn't do it right, or that they did too much, or whatever's going to happen.
They did too little. Got it,
or they did too little. And you know, people just, I mean, to me, my first impulse was to say none of them should go. They should just boycott. And then someone pointed out to me on one of the social media sites, Well, if they did that, the Republicans would just fill in the seats, right? So nobody would see that there was nobody there. And I thought, because there is no law that says they can't sit there, right? So, who knows what works? But I think that, you know, what you're seeing, and I think it's coming from the stuff that Driftglass is talking about, the grassroots things that are happening at the state houses, the boycotts of Tesla and the protests outside of Tesla, this kind of stuff, and, you know, speeches by the Prime Minister of Canada, which were more forceful than anything I've heard from any Democrat. These are the kind of things that are sort of, you know, they're getting people to see that there's a way to resist in whatever way they can. Even Eliza Slotkin, who did the response, which I thought was actually pretty good, considering
too.
How bad most of these are. And that was one of her best messages on there, was, look, do something, find something you care about, go out and start your own movement, you know, do something like that. And I thought, this is how it's going to happen, because you cannot count on Washington, D.C. Democrats to be able to do this on their own. I know we all think we should have a big leader who is out there, you know, giving us our marching orders and telling us what to do. But the truth is, as Drifty just said, they don't know what to do. So they're basically trying everything, you know. Yeah, I don't know if they're trying everything they can, but they're trying things.
Yeah,
and that's the best we can hope for.
There's this idea that Democrats are just doing a terrible job. They're wimping out. And I don't mean to make excuses for them here at all, but I'm not looking to Democrats to save the day. If they do, no, that's fantastic. I'm looking at we the people, whether it's voting, whether it's protesting, whether it's bringing these ideas. I'm looking at the people leading the Democrats, leading the elected officials to do the right thing. I'm not disappointed that the Democrats aren't doing better. I expect that they're not going to do better. It seems like it's always up to we the people. Let me, though, I digress here for a moment. Driftglass, Trump had said early on in the speech that he'd, quote, stopped all government censorship and brought back free speech in America. And then in the very next sentence, he boasted about signing an order making English the official language of the U.S., which does not sound very free speechy. And he then declared that he had renamed the Gulf of Mexico the Gulf of America, which, because AP refuses to call it that because it's in international territory, they have been barred from the White House from press avails, and they've had to sue the administration, charging violation of First Amendment free speech right. Again, is there any chance? These things seem to me to be so blatant, but maybe it's just me. Is there any chance that any of Trump's supporters who spent years pretending that they had their own free speech taken away from them somehow by Joe Biden on Twitter, is there any chance that anybody noticed any of this? Or is it just the four of us sitting around beating our heads against the wall?
I have decided I'm going to get you a copy of 1984 for Christmas.
What?
And I'm going to mail it to you.
What?
And we're going to read it aloud, you and me together on the phone. Because,
okay,
this is doublethink. This is, you know, switching your... And I call them this, and I call them with love, of reprogrammable meatbags. Because they're just reprogrammable. They can be told one thing on Monday, the opposite on Tuesday. They don't notice the difference. They don't care. Their motivation is not ours. This is a mistake that liberals and Democrats often make. They keep attributing compassion and kindness and thoughtfulness and thinking about the future and not being a hypocrite to people who have none of that in their heads. They want to make us cry because they believe that the worst thing that ever happened to America, modern America, was electing that black man to the White House and then electing Joe Biden, which is why Joe Biden is the worst president who ever lived ever in history. And this is what they believe. And he is playing to that belief. So anything is permissible to stop the baby-killing, America-hating, terrorist-loving commie liberals. And therefore, they don't care that it seems hypocritical. They're getting their free speech back. They can say whatever they want, and there's no consequences anymore. And besides, remember, God chose him to do this, Brad.
Well, let me.
I heard it in the middle of the speech. You know, God chose me
That's
to save
right.
America.
That's right.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Well,
so,
will they still feel that way? And I think your answer will probably be yes, they will. But let's find out. Well, let's talk about Trump's yearning. not unlike Vladimir Putin's yearning in Russia to rebuild the old Soviet empire, Trump's yearning to build a new American empire. He said we will be taking Greenland, I think his words were, quote, one way or another. So I'm wondering what he means by that. Who will the U.S. be attacking first here, Denmark over Greenland or Mexico over fentanyl? And will, in such a case, will these programmable meat bags, as you lovingly describe them, still stand for that after they've, you know, spent years pretending they were against things like George W. Bush and the war in Iraq and all of that?
Why did they make us do this, Brad? Well, Panama in their saucy way. Did you see how they're dressed?
Blame
they're
the victim.
Asking for it. They absolutely. This is, you know, read their playbook. This is not hard. It's just they keep doing it. And we keep expecting them to be other than what they are. And we keep being disappointed that there's nobody inside the husks of these people to reach, because there isn't. So no, they'll blame the victim. They'll, you know, they'll do wag the dog. They'll, you know, what was the line from Citizen Kane? You know, give me the war, I'll give you your headlines. They'll make it up. Fox News will have provocative stuff going on in Panama and those darn Greenlanders and their anti-American ways, and we're just going to have to go in like Grenada and free those people there, Brad.
Okay,
and you know, and the same people will fall for it.
Yeah,
Their kids get exported there, and then it's going to be a different story.
It is the same people, by the way, because you know I have been enjoying in recent years these Republicans who are pretending like it, just as Donald Trump pretended that he was against the Iraq War. He wasn't against the Iraq War; he was in favor of it. And all of these people who are pretending that I never voted for George W. Bush. I didn't like him. Whatever. They are the very same people. You can tell because you know we were all there. We all met those people. We all met those angry Republicans who were, you know, calling people like the four of us terrorists for pointing out that it was all a big mistake and so forth and a disaster. Now they agree it's a disaster, but they want to pretend those aren't the same people. These are the very same people. They can be, you're right, programmed to buy anything. To that end, Heather, you wrote about this today, as you noted, over at Salon, Trump's false Social Security claims that he and Elon Musk and Doge are finding, quote, billions and billions of dollars worth of fraud at Social Security, though to date they've shown zero evidence of any such fraud. But he then took a really long time to run through a whole bunch of numbers, phony numbers, suggesting there's millions of people who are 150 to 300 years old who are somehow receiving Social Security payments. You have a theory of why he did that. Why did he do that? Why did he spend all of our time on that stuff that we already know to be nonsense?
Right. One might have assumed, since he has promised in every election that he would, every campaign, that he would not touch Social Security and Medicare. That was just a given. He was not going to do it. Don't worry. That is off the table. Why would he spend all that time in that speech last night talking about Social Security and what the Doge has found in there? And he went into that long, long list of that in detail that was far too, you know, minute for anybody to really follow, as you said earlier, you know, listing off numbers. What a great way to do a speech.
Yeah, what does he think? He's hosting the broadcast? Well,
exactly. What the hell?
Right.
But there's a reason for it. What I was hearing as he was doing that was, I was hearing him in December of 2020 talking about the vote counts in places like Detroit and in Atlanta, and going on and on about that, you know, to people, going on and on about these with these numbers and these details. And it occurred to me that he's establishing a narrative, that what he's doing is setting up this idea for people, his people, the people who believe everything he says, that there is this massive fraud in the Social Security system, which is going to require that some changes be made. And we don't know what those are. We know that Musk already and his Doge they're cutting the Social Security personnel by half, which is massive. Mm-hmm. And they're closing half of the offices mm-hmm. that serve people. So Social Security, and we were just warned this week by Martin O'Malley, who was the former Social Security commissioner, mm-hmm. that we can expect that this disruption, particularly of the computer systems, which have been very efficient, even though there are people on the roll on the rolls that say that they're, you know, that it says they're 150 years old, they're not getting, nobody is getting any Social Security benefits. Right. It just hasn't been tagged that they died, right?
Yep.
So, and they've done these audits. They know that that's true. And there's, you know, there's something like 83,000 people over the age of 100 in America who are receiving Social Security. Mm-hmm. That sounds right. Out of 350 million people, that sounds about right. Mm-hmm. But they're setting us up here. They're coming for Social Security. Don't kid yourself. And the main reason that we know this is because Elon Musk, who has become Trump's brain, he just went on Joe Rogan last week, and he said that Social Security is the biggest Ponzi scheme in history. It's not the first time we've heard that, but it's the first time we've heard that from somebody who has the actual power to change Social Security unilaterally with no help from Congress. Now, Congress will put up a fit. They'll be upset. Even Republicans could be upset by this. Who cares? What are they going to do about it?
Yeah.
Well, how do they stop it? And by the time it wins its way through the courts, if it does, and it gets to the Supreme Court and they all have an epiphany and decide that this is really bad, how many people will have suffered? How much destruction will have happened to the Social Security system? And by the way, Medicare, don't kid yourself, that's happening too. They have a little bit of a difference there because there are hospitals with an interest in that, and there's, you know, there are doctors and other, you know, special interests that can weigh into that. Social Security is a pure program. It is just a pure government program. You know, here you go, here's your check. We
and
take
no
money
one to
out
advocate.
Of these guys to you get this. And yeah.
No
and
lobbyists
this is,
to advocate.
Well, yeah, there's no big money interest there other than just the humans that need the money. So, you know, watch out for this, because I truly, what I heard from him was a change in attitude about Social Security, which he has never had until now, in which he's now saying that there's something wrong with it and something needs to be done.
Which,
so just get ready.
Which brings me to my last question. Heather, you already spoke a little bit about this and why you think this is going on because of Donald Trump's just undescribable hate against everybody, including the American people. But we've been talking about this. I want to get Bill's thoughts on this. We've been talking about this question quite a bit on the show over the last several weeks, but I haven't had a chance to ask either of you about it. Why is Trump, as you see it, Bill, Driftglass, why is he destroying essentially the federal government? Why would he go against Social Security? All these things that he's doing are actually very unpopular. These cutting of these programs, these firing of employees, they're unpopular even among his own voters. I understand what is in it for Elon Musk, get his companies off the hook for all sorts of things, you know, blocking regulations and the investigations against him. But I really don't understand what is in it for Trump. There aren't, you know, enough employees in the federal government to fire that would pay for all of his tax cuts if he fired them all. None of this is making him more beloved by the American people, which seems to me to be most important thing to him, more important than anything. What is his game here as you see it? Heather says it's just because it's just, you know, unrivaled hate against the world. How do you see it?
Well, I mean, ask yourself, if he were a Russian asset, would he be doing anything different? If his job was to gut the country from the inside, would he be acting any different? I don't know that he is, but he certainly acts like one. The Republicans have fed their base. And this is where being beloved by the American people, I think, is a false choice, because there isn't an American people anymore. There are distinct blocks of people out there. And he wants to be beloved by the base. And the base has been told for 50 years that Social Security is a scam, that government workers are thieves, that welfare queens are taking their money, and on and on and on. And everything in the government's awful. The government is the problem, to quote Ronald Reagan. And he's going through there going, smashy, smashy, smashy. I'm going to bust this up. Look at all these corrupt people in Social Security. And we're going to save this system for you, the good people of America. And by the time it's a bust out, by the time he's done gutting the place, smashing it up, taking his share and leaving, there'll be nothing left of the government if he gets his way.
And
it'll be broken.
And he'll be the most unpopular American who has ever lived. Which is why it doesn't make sense. I understand his anger. I understand why he might want to do this. I don't understand why he is actually doing it, because it seems in the end it ain't going to help him much.
Well, let me ask you this. Do his followers still believe the 2020 election was stolen?
Yes, they do.
Will his followers believe that the reason Social Security broke was because of deep state conspiracies against them that he heroically was trying to stop, but he was prevented from stopping by something, 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 George Soros?
Well, to be determined, unfortunately, because we've got to get out. My apologies. I wish we could continue on, but we'll talk to you guys both, I hope, soon enough. And I think this is a question we're going to be asking over and over again as things devolve. Anyway.
Just hate, Brad. It's just hate.
All right. Just
believe
hate.
Me, that's all it is. He doesn't care if people love him. He's just on a total vengeance tour. That's what this is about.
All right.
He's getting his revenge against everybody.
And he gets to
the only thing that fully explains it.
All right. And I do think that he's absolutely terrified of Vladimir Putin, which we saw in the Oval Office on Friday, which may be a part of this answer, as Bill suggests. But we'll come back to it. I promise. Thank you, guys. I got to get out. My apologies.
Yep.
Driftglass, you can find him over at his blog, driftglass.blogspot.com. You can download the Pro Left podcast at proleftpod.com. You can find him on the Blue Skies at Driftglass. And you can find Heather Digby Parton over there. She is, who is she? Digby56 over at Blue Sky.
I don't know.
You'll also find her on salon.com and digbysblog.net. Thank you, guys.
My pleasure.
All right, and thank you very much, Desi Doyen.
Yeah.
You're welcome that I didn't make you stay up all night to record sounds from that
snoozer of a speech.
Well, because nobody wants to hear it. I don't need to give a platform to this guy to lie some more, do I?
Snoozer and screechy.
Thank you very much, Desi Doyen, our producer. Thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program or any other that we've ever done, you can download them all for free at bradblog.com. Thanks to those of you kind enough to hit a donate button while you're there, or stop by bradblog.com/donate to help us stay on your public airwaves. We couldn't do it without you. Thank you. Drop me an email if you like. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the social medias, especially Blue Sky, you'll find me at TheBradBlog. Hope to see you there and everywhere else. Until we see you here tomorrow, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.